once again, my friends, to the Global Gale podcast. My name is Philip O'Connor, coughing and spluttering my way into the spring of 2024. I hope you're well wherever you are in the world. Jesus, lads, I got some amount of colds this year, and it's really slowed me down in the first part of the year in terms of getting the podcast out every week as I should. So if I have interviewed you in the recent past and it's taken a little bit longer than what you might expect for that episode to come out, I can only say mea culpa, but I've been coughing and schnotting and all sorts of things. And it's gotten to the extent where our house here in Stockholm in Sweden, where I'm talking to you from, is usually full of Lemsip, and there's now no Lemsip left. Lads, this has never happened before. We're through the looking glass here. This is, I'm not going to use the word pandemic, lads, because it's just gone nuts altogether, and it's probably only me as well. But yeah, it's been a wild winter on that front altogether, but I'm hoping now that the advent of spring is going to have me feeling better. What never stops is the wonderful people getting in touch with wonderful stories to tell. And this week is a story that I've been waiting to tell for a long time. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so on patreon.com/ourmaninstockholm. Become a monthly patron there, help to keep the lights on. I came across this young man, Thomas McAnseer. That was very weird altogether. There was part Swedish pronunciation, part Irish pronunciation, man. Tomas, it should be. Tomas is a Gaelgor from County Kerry in Ireland. And I saw him, I don't know how he popped up on my social media, but I remember catching my eye and going, hang on a second, did I read that right? Is this lad really going to cycle from New Zealand all the way to Ireland, or what's the story here? And immediately I can feel your ears pricking up with your earbuds, lads, because, or your AirPods, because that's the kind of thing that just, that we get going on that on the Global Gale podcast. That's the kind of thing that we want to hear. So I got in touch with Tomas, and as often happens, Irish people are brilliant for you. You dropped him a DM, and it might be a Hollywood celebrity or a Premier League footballer or an NBA player or whatever, they never answer. Irish people will answer instantaneously the minute they say, oh yeah, how are you, Sham? Thanks very much for getting in touch. How are you keeping? Where are you living? All that kind of thing. So I got in touch with Tomas, but at the time it wasn't really ideal in terms of doing the interview, because he was in Iran at the time. And as you'll hear in the interview, he was talking about the difficulty of being in a place maybe where Big Brother is watching you, and sort of contrasting that with the life that he was leading there and the friendly people that he met and how great they all were to him. And I thought it was a fascinating idea altogether. So that is this week's conversation. Tomas is now back in Ireland. His bike is safely parked in Dubai. He's gone back there to replenish the muscles and to replenish the bank account, no less. And he's going to be going back out again to complete the last leg of his trip. But it's an absolutely amazing trip. And in one way, I mean, Tomas is very well aware of how privileged he is to be able to go and cycle around the world and that kind of thing. And then the other thing that this conversation got me thinking was, Jesus, why not, lads? Why not just work for 6 months and save up all the money you can and then go and do something nuts? Now, I'm vastly aware as well that many are probably doing that in Australia or in Africa or somewhere in South America, and I'm just an elf who doesn't understand how these things work. But it sounds like a fantastic way to go and collect experiences. So here you are. From County Kerry, via New Zealand, via Africa, via Lions, via cycling across America, it's Tomas McAnseer on the Global Gale podcast. Tomas, Fáilte go dtí on podcast. This is just an amazing story altogether. You cycled from India home to Kerry, is that right?
India to UAE. I left my bike in Dubai, so I'll go back again in next winter and I'll pick up where I left off and hopefully finish it off this time.
Right. So this is part of a sort of a long journey. We mentioned just before we started recording there that you'd actually sort of left your bike in Vietnam and then you brought it to India. Where did this idea come from about cycling basically across the entire world? What made you want to do this?
I finished university in 2016, and it was actually a friend who put the idea of cycling across America into my head. So I looked into that, and I'd like, before then I was only just kind of cycling around Kerry and Galway where I was up in university and stuff, so nothing too exciting. And then just realized you could pack up the bicycle and just live off it with your camping gear, your cooking gear, your belongings, your spare clothes, your electronics, etc. So yeah, took off and cycled across the States, loved it, went and did Africa. And it's the way it's worked out, it's just been like on and off, because I've been like working and trying to go back to university again to do master courses. I've got stuck in New Zealand during COVID as well, when I started the big journey that I'm on now of cycling home from New Zealand. So that's the one that's still in progress, nearly four and a half years later, but we'll slowly get there.
Were you sort of a competitive cyclist, or were you one of the Lycra lads on a Sunday morning just with the local club, or how did you get into cycling?
Used to cycle like anyone used to cycle as a kid, you know, just messing around with your friends and stuff. And then throughout my teenage years, I was playing Gaelic football and soccer. And then I guess I started cycling back to football trainings. I think I was around 17, and Dad was watching the Tour de France on TG Carter one of the days in the summer, and I was like, "Jeez, I'd love to get one of those bikes." So went off into Tralee, bought the bike, and then that was it then. I was probably 17, 18 years old at this stage, and just loved the freedom that it gave me. You know, you like going back football training, it's set times every week, then you've a match at the weekend and stuff. And whereas with the bike, I could just go out whenever I wanted to go out, you know, go as far as I go as fast or as slow as I wanted to go, spend as many hours as I want outside and stuff. And then it just took off from there. But no, I'd never competitive cycled or anything like that. Just it was just a hobby, you know. And then it just grew into this big world cycle that's now too addictive to stop.
I was going to say that because, like, you know, you get this idea, oh yeah, I'd like to be out for a few hours, etc. That's one thing around Kerry. It's another thing entirely to pack your bike and go to New Zealand or to go to cycle across America and that kind of thing. And where did this love of travel come from? Have you always been curious? Have you always wanted to see the world in this way?
No, not really. Like I started the States cycle, I was 22. So I guess in a way I was a bit of a late developer to this world traveling stuff. Because I've met plenty of people that have been much younger than me doing it. And then once I started it though, I just got hooked in it, you know. Just the interactions you have with people, the things you get to see every day, the experiences you get to have. And I guess being on a bicycle is probably one of the best ways to do it. Because you're traveling fast enough that you can get from A to B, like, you know, you can cover your 100K a day, but then you're also going slow enough that you can just take everything in, you know, and you need to stop. You need to stop for food, you need to stop for water, you need to stop for rest breaks and stuff. And then just the more I saw, the more I wanted to see. So like that's what probably brought me to Africa then, because I think at that stage I thought I might have time for one big trip, because I was meant to go back and do a master's course, and I was just like, okay, do the master's course and probably full-time work and everything else, and then all of a sudden you have wife and kids and no chance to go anywhere again. But then yeah, just got addicted to it all. So
Getting it out of your system now before you have to grow up, you know, kind of thing.
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But when you're cycling across Africa, right? Because people are listening to this, they will sort of see Africa as being sort of, you know, you have North Africa, you have South Africa, you have a big ass desert in between. They might have seen the Paris-Dakar rally. How do you plan a route for that? Because every kilometer you go out your way, that demands energy and calories and effort from you, right? So you can't just take as the crow flies. How do you go about planning that?
Spoke to people who've done it before. So the thing with Africa is that there's basically two routes you can take down either East Africa or West Africa. We'll say which would probably be considered like the safest, most logical routes to take. Because like you said, there is a big desert at the top, the Sahara Desert. So even trying to navigate through that, you do have to plan quite carefully, but your road options are very limited as well. So like I took the East Africa option, and basically, you know, you've got your road going down south of Egypt. So you've got the road along the Nile, or you have the Red Sea route, and then the Red Sea eventually finishes. So you have to get back onto the Nile. So like you've two options to get down Egypt, then Sudan. There's only one road through the desert that was built by the Chinese about 20 years ago. Before that, it was just sandy tracks. An Irish guy did it back in, I think it was 85. He's from Cork, John Devine. But reading his book and how he had to push his bike through most of the desert, and eventually I think he took a lift with a truck, because it was just he just couldn't get through it. And then today, you know, when I did it, there was a beautiful paved road, probably one of the most nicest roads you could probably cycle on, no potholes, recently built by the Chinese, so it was just in perfect condition. And then the rest of Africa, like when you probably get into like Ethiopia, Kenya, when there's more route options and stuff, you just listen to local advice. You have an idea of where you want to go yourself from what other people have done. And just, you know, plenty of people have traveled to these places now. So there's heaps of information online about it as well. But then, yeah, once you get into the nitty-gritty places, local advice is always best. And that's been even outside of Africa too, like in the Middle East where I was recently, you'd listen to locals a lot too, because they'd tell you where to go and pretty much where not to go as well.
You mentioned Ethiopia there. You mentioned that you've been through the Middle East, right? You started in India. I think when we were in touch the first time about talking, you were in Iran at the time. You have come through Afghanistan on the bike. Ethiopia, you mentioned, is quite a closed country. What's it like when you rock up to the border there, the pasty fella from County Kerry on his bike with his passport in his hand? Do they think you're mad, Tomas?
They'd be curious about the bicycle, all right, because they'd always ask like, "Where's the rest of your group or something?" And you're just like, "Oh, I'm on my own," and then they're like, "How are you traveling?" And I say, "My bicycle was left outside and stuff." And then bicycle, ha! They just have a big, the reaction would be hilarious. No, but then they're all for it. I've never, been stopped at a border being like, "Oh, you can't come in with a bicycle, like we're not going to let you do that, you mad lunatic," or anything like that. They've always been encouraged, or they've always given encouragement as well, so big thumbs up and a big smile and off you go. But yeah, once you have the visas and all the proper papers, and but you don't need any papers for the bicycle anyway, so once I have my own visa, it's fine.
So you work out the visas and all before you go, and you apply for them, and you get all the stamps you need and that kind of thing. And that sort of greases the wheels, to make a pun.
Yeah, exactly. Some visas you need to apply for in advance, other visas you just get at the border, depending where you are. So like the Middle East now, all of those visas I had to get in advance. Apart from UAE, I could get that on arrival. But like Iran, but there it's not too tricky to get them. You just need to just give yourself a couple of weeks, do some paperwork, and usually there's agencies you can give a bit of money to that'll do all that work for you. So you just need to provide your passport picture and your personal details, and that's it then. So it's not too bad. Yeah.
You mentioned the bike there. People are wondering where the rest of your team is, where the rest of your group is, and that kind of thing. And you point at this bike. What kind of a bike is it? I'm assuming this is not one where you just go down and, the local hardware store, the local supermarket, and just buy it off the shelf, is it?
You could do that. There's plenty of people that like go to Lidl and just buy a cheap 50 € bike and pack it up. My bike is an American brand, Trek. It's a Trek Tourer 920, so it's they don't make them anymore. But as adventuring bikes goes, it's pretty mid-market decent. Like it's not one of these 10,000 € bikes or anything like that. But yeah, no, it's a good bike. And then you've got the panniers on the rear rack. You got your pannier bags, you got your frame bags. So it's like every bit of space is taken up with bags or some bit of gear, some water bottles, or just anything you may need on a day-to-day basis. But it's a great bike though, because I can take it off road as well, so it's quite versatile. The only places I probably couldn't go is like proper mountain bike trails or anything like that, because you'd just be It's too heavy, so you'd have to just get off and lift and have to lift it then, because they get too steep.
For the listeners now who can't picture this kind of thing in their head, is it closer to being a racing bike or a mountain bike, or is it sort of somewhere in between the two? Which does it lean towards, would you say?
If you're looking at it more of a racing bike, because it does have like dropped handlebars, but then with the components, it's probably more of a gravel mountain bike type bike.
So
Yeah.
it's kind of like a hybrid thing. You mentioned the packing there. I'm sure, I mean, you can't exactly bring everything with you, right? So I'm sure you can almost list, the kind of stuff that you would have. You mentioned you bring all your own cooking gear. You bring a tent. Do you bring a tent and all that kind of thing as well? Yeah.
Yeah, tent, sleeping bag, sleeping mat, your little blow up pillow, and then yeah, the camp, the cooking gear. You just have maybe a spare set of clothes, a jacket or two, but then it like, depending where you are in the world, so you're cycling through so many different climates as well. So, like in the Middle East there, it was cold. I was up at 2,000 meters a lot, so I needed a couple of jackets. Whereas if I had been in Southeast Asia, I wouldn't need any jacket because it was 40 degrees every day. So sometimes you can post some stuff ahead, or send something home to get sent back out to you again, or just, yeah, usually just post them ahead, which is handy too. So it just means you don't have to carry all the gear, then you can carry more of what you actually need as well.
When you're on the bike, I mean, you, I think you said your target is kind of 100 kilometers a day kind of thing. Do you sort of look at the map in advance and go, okay, by tonight I want to be in this village? Would you ever book a room for yourself when you feel, you know, that, oh yeah, I'd love a nice night's sleep with a decent mattress and a pillow that I haven't had to blow up myself?
If I was going into cities, I would, yeah. But like small countryside towns and stuff, you could just bank on finding a car. Because a lot of, again, a lot of these places wouldn't have booking.com and stuff. Like you wouldn't be able to pre-book online. You could see on like Google Maps that there's hotels available, but it's just more of a you walk in and pay when you get there. But in the cities and stuff, I'd pre-book mostly like cheap hostels and stuff or a cheap hotel, just, you know, so that you have something to look forward to. But yeah, but most of the time, just wake up. You'd have an idea of where you're going, of course, but then usually I just cycle and see how far I can make it in one day. So some days you might make your destination, other days you mightn't. But
Are
you
you
always
ha
there's always a place to sleep though, so there's never any hassle.
Yeah. And do you sleep well in the tent and on the sleeping mat and that kind of thing? Are you the kind of guy who could just sort of conk out in the corner?
It depends. Most times I'd probably say no. Because usually there it's, you know, it's hot or there's mozzies or there's some noise or there's animals around. There was one night in Indonesia, I probably one of the hardest days cycling. It was boiling hot, it was stupid steep hills, and a lot of the time I had to get off and walk and push. So I only covered about 50K and I must have been out there for 10, 12 hours. And that night I camped on right beside the beach on top of the pier. And beside an old abandoned building, and lovely, like some lo lovely locals took me there to tell me that I could sleep there and stuff. And anyways, that night there was an earthquake. I think it was a 7.2 magnitude earthquake, but I had no SIM card, so I had no data. And I was so tired from the day that I woke up with all the shaking and stuff, and I was just like, Jesus, what's this now? And fell back to sleep, didn't think anything of it, fell straight back to sleep. I was that tired, woke up the next day. Didn't even remember it. It was only when I got to the town, and I think I did 150K. It was a big cycle that day, anyways, because I was getting to the main city of the island to get the ferry to the next island. And it was only when I got back onto Wi-Fi that the messages came through, and it was all my friends and family from Australia. Nobody from Ireland had heard about it, but the Aussies had, because it, I think it shook Darwin. And yeah, and I slept basically slept through it. And then obviously you're one, you know, my main concern then was like, Jesus, what if there's a tsunami? And there I was, thick Kerry man, just trying to sleep the night away and giving out that something had woken me up.
Right beside the water as well. It's like, yeah,
Yeah,
Jesus, could have had more problems than that. Is that the scariest thing that happened to you on the road? Because, you know, when you're out there, you and your bike and basically nothing between you and the stars kind of thing. I mean, I don't know if everybody would have the nerve to do what you're doing, Tomas.
It's usually traffic is obviously the biggest issue in pretty much every country I've been through, but scary things with people, no. The other maybe incidents would be animals in Africa. I had a couple of close calls with lions, one in Tanzania, one in Botswana. Like the one in Botswana, I had met two other guys at this stage, so we were setting up our tents and stuff and just gathering our belongings to jump into the tent. It was probably about 9, half 9 at night, so it was pitch dark. And we just all of a sudden heard the roar of a lion. We were in Chobe National Park, so it's this big, massive national park in Botswana, and the road just goes splits through it for 300K, and it's the main road, so all the warning signs are up, like, you know, to be careful of the wildlife, because you see it's called Elephant Highway, so you'd see elephants pretty much a few times every day. But anyways, the lion must have been about 20, 30 meters away, and we just jumped into one of the tents and knew as long as we stayed in a tent, we'd be safe. Because lions would see the tent as they'd see any building. It's something that they can't get access to. Even though if it clawed it open, it would have two tree lads inside waiting to be eaten. Nowhere to run.
A very tasty Kerry fella for the main course would be very pleasant
Yeah.
altogether.
And
Were there actually?
one of the other lads was Donegal as well. So a Kerry and a Donegal man inside there.
I'll tell you something, Irish beef sells at a premium abroad these days, pal. You want to be careful of that. But the
Yeah.
lions will actually see a tent to go, no, that's kind of like concrete. That's where humans are. And I'm going to stay away from that, or I'm just not going to get
Yeah.
anything out of that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's bizarre enough. There's another f video. I think it's on YouTube. There was someone camping. They were inside their tent, and I think it was more than one lion as well. I think a couple of them came over to the tent, but it was raining. And there was water dripping down the outside of the tent. So the lions came over and just started licking the water off the tent. Just they were thirsty. And then they went away as if, you know, that's it. Yeah, we got our drink and off we go. Did we leave whoever's inside alone?
I'm the same myself. I hate having to unwrap me food, you know, that way. You know? This time around in India, right, I'm thinking of the practicalities of this. As I say, you're one man out there on a bicycle under the stars, right? India is notorious for what they call Delhi belly, for, you know, you eat something, it doesn't disagree with you. Do you have the cast iron stomach that's necessary for traveling through Asia on a bike, do you?
I didn't. Southeast Asia, I was sick a lot. I had diarrhea multiple times. Ended up in hospital with it, and then I was had yeah a different hospital trip for different thing. But India never got sick. Pakistan never got sick, which was amazing really, because everyone seems to get sick between these two countries. So I think after my experiences in Southeast Asia that my stomach toughened up a bit and was able to deal with it. And I was eating street food, local food. You know, I wouldn't be going to fancy restaurants or anything like that, because you just wouldn't be able to afford to travel for too long if you're sticking to a budget like that. So, yeah, amazing, really, that no sickness.
Yeah. When you do eat, right, because obviously if you're cycling 100, 150 kilometers a day, you mentioned the mountains there and that kind of thing, right? You need a lot of calories every day. Is it cheap? Is it convenient? Was it literally, okay, there's a stand selling something, I don't care what it is, I'm just going to eat it?
Pretty much, yeah. But usually the trick is to go where locals go. So like if it's evening time and I'm looking for something to eat, I rarely walk into an empty restaurant. And you never know, like maybe it was busy before and just they were just quiet and it was going to get busy again. But the rule of thumb is just to stick to where locals eat, because at least, you know, the food, you know, they're going through a bit of food and stuff. So it's not going to be something that's just left over from previous days. Whereas that was my issue in Southeast Asia, because like parts of Indonesia where I was were quite remote. Sorry. But yeah, the rule of thumb is just to go where locals eat. But like one of my issues in Southeast Asia when I was in Indonesia, especially because some of the places would be quite remote. One of the islands I was on, I took an extremely remote route and there were like barely any tourists and stuff. So a lot of the food is cooked and then it's just left out in the display cabinets outside the front of the whatever cafe restaurant is there. So like, you know, when you're eating this food, you're just like, oh God, I'm going to pay for this tonight.
What was the best thing you ate? Let's not talk about the worst things that happened. What was the best thing you ate on your travels this time around?
God, I think I've always loved Indian food. Thai food was incredible. Vietnamese food. Probably like something like the weirdest thing I probably ate was, I think, goat's testicles in Tanzania, one of those countries, Malawi or someplace.
How did that go down?
I took a bite because somebody offered it to me, and it's you know, it's quite rude to say no. So I took a bite and pretty much spat a strip back out again. I think they knew from my reaction that that's not something I'm used to eating. So I was just thank you, but no, thank you.
it went entirely as expected, in other words, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned there about the various places that you've been through, right? We were talking when you were in Iran that time, and you were kind of a little bit worried about maybe publishing photographs or videos or podcasts or anything around that time. What made you conscious of your sort of safety and security there? Was it the people you were meeting, the people you were talking to? Was it just a sort of a bad vibe, or what was it?
No, just because in Iran, like if you step out of line, we'll say, because there is like rules and stuff to follow, even as being a traveler passing through. You know, you don't take photographs of women, you don't take photographs of like oil tankers, any gas stations, any like anything that's just sensitive in within the country, any government buildings, military buildings. But this is probably the same for most countries. But even when I was staying with local people, and this would be a no-no, because I think by the government, locals aren't meant to take in travelers. We're meant to go stay in hotels and stuff. But everyone, you know, locals they've been taking in travelers for as long as I can remember anyways. But even when you're leaving some of their houses, you know, they'd be like, oh, like if anyone stops you, don't tell them where you stayed. Just tell them you slept at a mosque or you camped outside of town or something. So even from the local point of view, they didn't want me telling other people that I had stayed with them, just in case if it came back to them again. And I don't even know, like, when I apply, like, if I decide to go back to Iran again next winter, because I could still travel through Iran on my way back to Turkey. I'm not too sure about if I'm going for a second visa, will they need evidence of where I stayed? Because, I mean, I could probably count on one hand the amount of times I had paid accommodation there that, you'd have evidence of. Everything else was either in a tent or at a local's house or at a mosque or whatever. So, but yeah, I just didn't want to bring trouble to anyone, and that's the, because people were so good to me there. They took so much good care of me, and I didn't want to basically post something up that maybe I shouldn't have posted out of naivety or whatever, or just not knowing. And then, someone's looking through my phone, and then they're like, "Oh, well, who are these people?" And give me their address, give me their phone numbers, because I know there is some borders that you pass when you come into Iran, that they look through your phone, and if they see Iranian numbers, they'll ask you, who are these people? How come you have their number? And I think they even go as far as calling these people as well and asking them about you. So, yeah, it's just a bit of hassle.
Yeah, you don't want to be putting people in a situation of danger, especially when they're sort of, hospitable enough to take you in.
Yeah,
On that
exactly.
note, how do those interactions work when you bump into somebody and, do they go, "Oh, do you want a place to stay?" Or do you go, "Jesus, could you give me a bed?" Or how does it usually happen that you end up staying with somebody in that way?
If they were to offer you a place to stay, it's probably one of the first questions they'll say to you. But then people are always curious. So, like, if I was cycling, people would be beeping, they'd roll down the window, they'd drive up alongside you, or they'd just pull in and they'd ask you to pull over, and they'd be chatting away to you, and they'd give you food. They'd say something like, "Oh, like, what can I do to help you? What can I do to make you feel welcome in Iran and stuff?" And then, you're in towns, villages, people, you go for food, you're walking the streets, you parked up the bike, you're at a shop or whatever. People are always asking, like, where you're going, where are you from? And yeah, but Iran, I suppose, because of US sanctions, they've had a pretty tough time of it economically wise anyways. And the currency, like, I change a $100 bill and you get a stack of cash like that big, it's completely worthless. So they can't, it's difficult for them to get out of the country. It's difficult for them to get visas, and it's difficult for them to just have enough money to, I guess, travel, So their way of, I guess, interacting with tourists is from tourists who come through Iran. And a lot of people visit Iran. It's an incredible country, history-wise, culture-wise. And then if you're overlanding, like whether you're cycling like me, or if you're driving or on a motorbike, if you're going to Central Asia from Europe, Iran is the country you go through. Everyone transits through Iran. So, I mean, for us, I'm incredibly grateful that the country is actually open to get through. Because, with the regime in charge, it could easily be one of these countries that's just like, "Oh, no, we're not letting foreigners in. We don't want them in here. We don't want them to see what's going on here and stuff." So it's great that it's still open, and it's great that we can interact with local people. We can stay with them. Obviously done on the sly, but I like, even the ones I stayed with, like, you might think, "Oh, what about the neighbors? What if they saw something and then called someone and they were like, 'Oh, geez, we saw this foreigner looking fella on a bicycle going into one of these houses here, what's his deal? Should he not be in accommodation or something?'" But thankfully that never happened.
And would they expect anything from you? If they, would they expect a few quid from you or that kind of thing? Did that ever come up at all?
No, never. And you'd offer, but they'd never. It was almost as if you were insulting them. They were it's just the culture that's there, and in Islam culture as well, and this is probably important to point out too, it's written that, you have to take care of your guest. The guest is well respected, and that's Iran. I first experienced it in Egypt and Sudan when I passed through there, especially Sudan. So you have Sudan, Iran, countries I've been through, so Pakistan, Afghanistan would be the same type culture as well. The guest is respected, and that they want to help you and they want to take care of you. And when you're at someone's house and their food's been bought out, it's a big deal. So, like, they do make a big deal out of it. So they bring their friends over, they bring their family over, you're put on the phone to people, and if they have any, like, I would have stayed with a couple of people who had friends or relatives living here in Ireland, And I'd be put on the phone to them, and you know, most of them might be up in Dublin studying or living or over in Galway or someplace, but you'd be chatting away to them too, having a bit of crack as well. So,
It's deadly,
and
isn't
for me, it's great as well because you know, you're on your own pretty much all day on a bicycle and kind of just chatting away to yourself, and you feel as if you're losing your sanity a small little bit. And one of the reasons why I still travel like this or still have the motivation to do it, because I did start 8 years ago, is that just the interactions with people. You know, it's not the case that you're looking for freebies or anything, but you just want to meet as many people as you can. You want to sit down and chat to them. You want to, and whether it be at their house or on the streets or in cafes or if they pull over on the side of the road or whatever. So every interaction is a great one.
Yeah, I remember one time I went to visit a friend of mine. I had to get something off him very briefly. We just needed a chat for 10 minutes, and his mother-in-law is Kurdish, and she came in and she was offering tea and she's offering food and everything else. I was going, no, Mrs. You're grand. Like I'm in a bit of a hurry here, but it's grand. Thanks very
You
much.
can't say no
She was
because bring it out regardless.
incredibly insulted, like
Yeah,
unbelievably insulted. I've never done it since, I can tell you, you know.
yeah.
We mentioned it a little bit in passing there when you were talking about food and hotels and budget and that kind of thing, right? I know your family has a pub. What's the name of the pub that your family owns there in Kerry?
Tig and Tirsig, Sayers Pub. It's in Ballyfarter village, about 8 miles west of Dingletown. So it's on the Slayhead Drive. So if you're driving Slayhead, you'll pass right by the front door.
I hope that everybody who listens to the Global Gael podcast who's around Slayhead now this summer will go in and pay us a visit, right? But is that how you finance it? Do you do your work for your family in the pub and then save your few bob, and then when you have enough money, you head out again, or do you have sponsors, or how do you manage to get around the world on the bike?
No, I've had a bicycle sponsored by Vitus. They're up in Belfast, so they got in touch with me before I went to Africa. But the rest of it, just whatever I've earned myself. Thankfully, once you kind of get all the gear out of the way, the flights, some, you know, and then it's not like once you're actually on the road physically, you know, you can live off. And some people live off $5 a day. That's a bit extreme. It's a bit difficult to do, but like maybe $10, $15. And then I guess because my cycles are, you know, they're broken up as well. You know, I'm back home now. What is it, March? I'll be probably working straight through to November, pretty much every day. So I'll save a good bit again before I head off again. But once you're actually on the road cycling, it's a cheap way to travel because you're not going to fancy restaurants. I'm not going to fancy, you know, I think it's gas because sometimes I do wonder like how people think I can afford it the whole time because it is a question I've often been asked, and I'm just wondering like do people think like I'm staying in like decent hotels every night to get proper rest or having good meal like steak dinners every night and bottles of wine or beers or whatever. And it's just like, no, I'm literally just like scraping the bottom of the barrel. I travel as cheap as I can. And they're probably thinking, oh, typical Kerry man, like trying to save his few bob and all this kind of stuff. But nah, once you're out there, I just I eat local food, you know, stay in cheap hostels, cheap hotels. Like, you know, I've had bed bugs in beds. I've had nights where you can't sleep because of wherever you're staying. It's not the nicest looking place, or it's noisy, and it's not obviously something you could probably complain about to someone because it's just like, oh, yeah, it's like get over it. You're staying in like a $5 bed, so but yeah, no. Once you're out there, it's, but then like costs could add up, like you know your visas, you know sometimes you have to fly, and then other stuff like bike mechanic stuff and all that kind of stuff. So it does add up as well after a while, but.
Am I right in saying that you had an issue with a pedal once where you basically threw the bike together and then the pedal sort of, well, you wore out the thread in it after about 15 minutes kind of thing?
Yeah, I'd flown from Oz, Australia to East Timor, and I put the bicycle back together at the airport, but it was hot and sweaty, and I had people watching me do it. So there was security. There was something going on there. So there's a few security guys, and you know, there's one of these countries where people are just curious of whatever the foreigner does and stuff. So I over-treaded the pedal, and it was a few days later. I was way out in the countryside, and the pedal just came straight off, and I was just like, "Ah, oh, bollocks!" And it was close to Christmas as well. I think it was the 22nd of December, and I couldn't get a replacement in East Timor, so I had to get either one shipped from Australia. But because it was Christmas time, it was going to take weeks and weeks to get there, or else I could get one shipped from Bali. So I found, I think it was a German or Dutch guy who runs a bicycle shop in Bali, and he got one sent to me within a couple of weeks. So it wasn't too bad. So I just rented it. I ended up renting a scooter, which is probably a better, it probably worked out better because the roads I traveled on were absolutely horrendous. East Timor, it's just been, it's just got independence in the last 20 years. It had a brutal invasion and occupation by Indonesia. So a lot of the roads are in terrible, terrible state. So I don't think the bicycle, if I had continued on the bicycle, I think the bicycle would have been absolutely broken into pieces. So it was probably better off. It did break where it did break, and I was able to rent a scooter than to see the rest of the island.
Oh, I suppose changing one pedal is one thing, but trying to rebuild an entire bike after those East Timorese roads might be a little bit too much, you know?
Yeah, but it was still expensive to send the pedal over from Bali, so it did take a good chunk out of my budget. And East Timor, it's not one of these cheap Southeast Asian countries. It's probably one of the more expensive ones to travel, just because it's not, they barely get any tourists there, so it's not developed for tourism. So yeah, that did take a good chunk out of the budget.
You've been doing this now for 8 years. You've seen most of the world. You've been through Africa. You've been across America. You're now, let's say, halfway, well, most of the way across Asia and then into the Middle East, right? Do you think doing this has changed you in any way, Tomas?
I definitely have more of a positive outlook in the world. Because with everything going on, even today, you know, it's great to remind yourself that like 99% of the people are actually good people. So yeah, definitely see the world with a much more positive outlook. And even just myself, like I've definitely grown in confidence myself. Like when I was younger, when in teenage years, I was like playing sports and stuff, but never took it like extremely serious or anything like that. I had more interest in just sitting upstairs and playing video games. So I was pale, you know, probably not the most healthiest of looking fellas. But yeah, once the cycling started and the traveling started, definitely grew in more and more in confidence and stuff. And hopefully like to think that I'm a better person for the experiences I've had, you know, how often I've been taken in by people, how people have helped me everywhere in the world. So always trying to give back where I can as well. So yeah.
You mentioned to me there that your bike is currently in Dubai, right? So Dubai was where you got to. Is that basically locked to a post there and you're going to go and collect it in November? Or how does this work?
No, it's at my cousin's house, so it's safe. Yeah,
no, I'm delighted to hear that. Not that Dubai is a very safe country or is a very safe place anyway, like, you know. But is that where you're going to sort of pick it up and start again? Did you fly to Dubai or had you cycled all the way there?
So when I finished up in Iran, because I detoured through Afghanistan, I realized I could travel through when I was in Pakistan. So I was like, well, got to go through Afghanistan. So I added quite a substantial detour. So by the time I got to Tehran, I had unfortunately run out of time. So I kind of finished that cycle in Tehran. And then I wanted to go see there's some historic cities in Iran to visit, like Shiraz, Isfahan, like incredible, incredible places. And the only way I could do that and get to Bandar Abbas was probably taking a bus. So the last stretch I just bussed and cycled, but I'm not counting that as part of my actual cycle. But then from Bandar Abbas I took a ferry to Dubai. So that was just the last couple of weeks.
And that was for the last part of it. So you'll go back now to Dubai, the plan is, at some point in November. Have you decided where you're going to start from again now?
Probably just from Dubai, I'd say. Just continue from there towards, what I might do is probably take a bus to Oman, to Muscat. And then, because then I'm kind of going in the wrong direction. So I'll head back east, head to Oman, because I really want to see Oman because it's meant to be a beautiful country. So I'll do Oman and then continue from there, probably back into UAE and then onto Saudi and up through Saudi, hopefully Jordan. Yeah, I'm just trying to link all this in, but I'd like to see Jordan too and then get to Iraq. And then from Iraq, I could probably go back into Iran and then back and then into Turkey. And then from Turkey straight to Istanbul, and that's my gateway into Europe.
I love how you list off those places as if they were sort of neighboring counties.
And
in the afternoon, I'll be in Turkey, and so then I'll be nearly home, kind of thing, you know? When you're standing behind the bar in the family pub now, is this a topic for discussion among the locals or indeed the tourists that come to your family's pub there?
Yeah, it would be like a lot of the locals are they're always following the trips and stuff. So they'd be asking, they're just as curious as well. And I have kind of a poster which I need to update up in the bar as well. That poster is only from the America cycle, so that one was 8 years ago. So I'll update that hopefully before the summer. Because it is a good talking point, because like I've made a lot of contacts from the pub as well, and even just from like friends or local people saying it to other people as well, because they might see, oh, gee, Tomas is going through Saudi Arabia, like, and they'll always know people out there. So I've got great contacts from that as well. So
It's amazing altogether. Do you meet many Irish people on your travels? I'm thinking through. I mean, there are Irish people absolutely everywhere. That's why we do this
yeah.
podcast. You've bumped into a few, have you?
Oh yeah, you'd see them everywhere. Like I think I could probably list off some countries I didn't, but most countries I would have, like Afghanistan, Sudan, I wouldn't have seen any Irish, but I think every other country you'd see them in some sort of a capacity. And the foreign affairs have been great, like the embassies, the ambassadors and his team, they've always been wonderfully kind to me as well. But yeah, but it's great meeting them though, because like, sometimes like in Iran now, you're just chatting to local people all the time. So it was nice when I got to Tehran, I was able to meet a couple of the Irish community, and it's just like being back at home again. You're just having a crack and piss taking and chatting over tea or whatever, like, or a bit of food and stuff. So it was just nice just to sit back in like homely company again, and it's just, yeah, it's just relaxing.
I suppose it's lovely to get that little bit of a break among all the hard cycle and the weather and that kind of thing. Is Scéal, how can people follow your journey? Are you usually on Instagram when you're traveling away there if you have a bit of Wi-Fi?
So Instagram, it's at unbotharfada. So ANBOTHARFADR. So that just basically means the long road. And then Twitter is Tomas at Tomas World Cycle, Tomas World Cycle. And the same on Facebook, Tomas World Cycle, it's a cycle page.
Brilliant. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you and finding out how to do these things. I hope that people are feeling inspired. Not me, because I'm too old for that kind of crack. I'll happily take the nice hotel beds and the limousines and that kind of thing. But and we will continue to follow. Do let us know on the podcast when you head out on your travels again. We'll continue to follow. But for now, Tomás, go meet him.
Thanks a million, Philip. Gramil Margaret.
There you go. What an incredible character altogether. What an incredible athlete. What an incredible way to go about seeing the world. And I've seen in the meantime, since I recorded that interview there with Tomas, we had that English fellow who was after running around Africa or the length of Africa or up Africa or down Africa. What was his name? Hard Geezer or something. He only finished there over the weekend. I was thinking how much slower that must have been when you compared to being on a bike, and you would have seen, Billy Connolly and these lads doing it on a motorbike or in a car or something like that. But huge kudos to Tomas as well, because the other thing about cycling that you never really think of is, or certainly I never really think of, I don't know if I'm an eternal optimist, but you never think of doing it in the rain. So you always think, oh yeah, that'll be lovely out there, the sort of, you can see the sort of the orange brown dust of the desert and that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden it's pissing rain. And of course, as Irish people, we should never be surprised by that. But yeah, a great story altogether. If you want to follow Tomas and I strongly suggest that you do, because it's an absolutely amazing story altogether. On Bohar Fada, ANBOTHARFADA on Instagram is the best place to get him. And you'll see pictures of his bike, and you'll see pictures of all his kit on his bike, and him standing there by it at the top of some mountain, and him in Indonesia, and him in India, and him all over the place. And it's, as I say, it's an amazing way. Even if you don't get up on your bike and feel inspired to do that yourself, you may have the chance to follow along on his journey that's gone from 2020 in New Zealand all the way back to Ireland. An amazing story altogether. That is it for this week on the Global Gael podcast. Next week, we have a bit of a sporting bent again. I've been talking to an Irishman in California who has an amazing company based around the area of data and sports science, and you're really going to want to hear this, whether you're into cycling or football or basketball or American football or anything. It's a fascinating conversation altogether. That's provided I can stay above ground, lads, because look at it, there's no guarantees in this world altogether. Hopefully I'll be 100% by then. I'm about 90% today and able to talk without coughing into the microphone, so it's not too bad. Listen, I shall let you go. Until next time, my friends, take care of yourselves, take care of one another. Tell your friends you've been listening to the Global Gael podcast and Tomas McInseer and on Bohar Father and all of those great things, and I'll talk to you all again very, very soon indeed. Good luck.